I hope that you've had a good day. And whether you've had a good day or a bad day or somewhere in between, there's not a better way to cap off a day's activity than coming together with those of like precious faith and going before the throne of God to worship Him. And certainly we could do that in the privacy of our home in our private devotions. But to do it with brethren, and to do it with those that we love somehow enhances that endeavor. And so we're glad that you're here tonight. And it's a challenge to put away from our hearts and minds the thoughts of this world, the cares that we have, the legitimate cares that we have, and to think for a little while about things that are spiritual. But that's what we're called upon to do each time we come together. And so I appreciate you being here for this meeting tonight. Appreciate those who are visiting that have come. We've had visitors for every evening service and perhaps had some Sunday morning as well. But we've had visitors, I know, every evening service. And appreciate all the visitors that have come and are grateful for all the members here that have been present. I know there are those that are members here that have been here every service. And to do that, you have to make it a priority. And you make the decision to be present. You are busy just like everybody else, and you could be doing something else just like other people are, but you've made it a priority to be here. And I appreciate your coming and being here for your meeting. The Bible tells us in 1 Peter chapter 5 in verse 8 that we have an adversary. That adversary is the devil. And Peter describes him as being like a roaring lion that walketh about through the earth seeking whom he may devour. The devil is after each and every person. He's after each and every one of us. And I don't know how often you think about it, but the devil is in this assembly tonight. He's seeking to devour us even here in this. There's nowhere in this world that we can gather where the devil will not come in and be amongst us. In our assembly such as this, when our families get together, wherever we may be, go off and find some still, quiet place for solitude for yourself, the devil will be there. And he's seeking to devour you. He's seeking to devour me. He wants to take us into an eternal hell, which, by the way, was not prepared for man, according to Matthew 25, verse 41. Those who are sent into that eternal fire are sent into that fire that is prepared for the devil and his angels. And though God will certainly allow man to have his will, and if he chooses to live without God here, then live without him eternally in that place prepared for the devil and his angels. That's what he wants to do. He wants to take you there. He wants to take me there. And he will use everything and anything at his disposal that might appeal to us, try to lure us into that. Now, he can only do what we allow him to do. In Ephesians 4:27, Paul said, neither give place to the devil, which means we could give him place, but we can choose not to. In James chapter 4 and verse 7, James says, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. After describing Satan as being like a roaring lion in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, he says, whom resist steadfast in the faith. He can be resisted. And we can resist him. He's not all-powerful. He can't overpower us and make us do anything that we do not choose to do. But that's what he's endeavoring to lead us into. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul addresses the church there and gives them some instruction concerning a man who had sinned and evidently had repented and sought to be restored. And now Paul is wanting them to make sure that they forgive him and manifest their love toward him in that forgiveness. It is generally believed and accepted by many, and I have no objection to that, this idea, but there are many who believe that the man of whom Paul speaks, who had sinned, was the man who was guilty of fornication with his stepmother, whom Paul addressed in 1 Corinthians 5. There, remember, he told the church that the next time they were come together, they were to withdraw from him. And evidently they did, and that discipline that was exercised, Paul says in 2 Corinthians, by many, had a good effect on this man, and he was restored. But it seems from what Paul writes here that there were some who were still a little bit hesitant about accepting his repentance. Maybe they thought he hadn't suffered enough for the heinous sin that he had committed, in their eyes at least. But Paul says, forgive him. And you'll notice there in about verse 10 or 11 where he says, to whom you forgive anything, I forgave. And to him whom I forgave, for your sakes forgave I it in the person of Christ. And then in verse 11 he says, lest Satan should get or gain an advantage over us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. I don't know about you, but I don't like to be taken advantage of. I have been. You have been. Every congregation of the Lord's people have been taken advantage of at one time or another. If you've done very much benevolent work at all, you have people who come begging for help that are not legitimately in need. And we have helped them because we didn't know any better. And they'll have to answer for that, not us. But we've been taken advantage of. We've been taken advantage of on a personal basis. But I don't enjoy that. And I suspect you don't either. And yet Paul says here that it is possible that Satan can gain an advantage over us. Now the word devices there in 2 Corinthians 2:11 is a word that refers to the mind and to the purpose. In fact, it is a word that is translated mind in chapter 3, in chapter 4, and chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians. It's translated by the word thought in 2 Corinthians 10. And thus, when Paul says we are not ignorant of his devices, he's saying that we are not ignorant of that which the devil thinks about and aims to do toward us. But let's think about tonight this idea of how Satan might gain an advantage over me or you. We wouldn't want to do that. And yet there are multitudes of people in the world today over whom Satan has gained advantage. He does that in the first place through our ignorance. There in 2 Corinthians 2:11, Paul says, for we are not ignorant of his devices. But what if we are? What if we are ignorant of all that the devil is endeavoring to do? Think of the multitudes of people in the world today who have no interest or inclination toward religion at all. They're going about living their lives every day for the here and now with little thought about eternity, if they even know about eternity. And those folks are folks over whom Satan definitely has gained an advantage because of their ignorance. They may not even know if there is such a thing as a devil. If there is, in their mind, it may be that caricature that we often see portrayed, cartoons and other means. And to them, he is not really so much a real person, more of a mythical person, and thus they don't think much about him. They're ignorant. We can be ignorant. In John 6, in verse 45, Jesus said, it is written in the prophets that they shall all be taught of God. Whosoever therefore hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. Jesus tells us that Christianity and being a disciple of Jesus is a matter of learning. It's not something with which we're born or into which we are born physically or by the flesh. Christianity is a learned religion. Now, when he says it's written in the prophets, he could have been referring to Isaiah chapter 2. He could have been referring to Jeremiah 31 and other places in the prophets where God foretold of the time when that new covenant would be established and the law would be written in their hearts and on their minds. When the people would say, "Let us go up to Jerusalem, to the house of the God of Jacob, and He will teach us of His ways." Perhaps he was referring to that, but it was written in the prophets. That unlike Judaism, where you were born into that covenant by the flesh and then had to be taught later the precepts and the responsibilities of being in that covenant relationship, you begin the relationship with God, with Christ, in that new covenant by first being taught. But what if you're not taught? That's the significance then of the Great Commission. To go and teach all nations, Matthew 28. To preach the gospel to every creature, Mark 16:15. There are people in the world today that know about Coca-Cola and McDonald's that don't know anything in the world about Jesus Christ. Over them, Satan has an advantage. But it's not always and only people who have never heard the gospel or who have never been in a covenant relationship with God. The prophet Hosea said in chapter 4 and verse 6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." In Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 13, the Lord through Isaiah said, "Therefore my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge." This was Israel in the case of Hosea, the northern kingdom that went into Assyrian captivity. Why? Because they did not have the knowledge they could have and should have had. When the northern kingdom separated and became the northern kingdom, when Israel divided under the reign of Rehoboam, the northern kingdom beginning under the rule of Jeroboam never had a good and godly king. Every king followed in the footsteps of Jeroboam, who set up the false worship with a false priesthood. And everything about it was false. And Satan gained an advantage over them because they ignored and were ignorant of the law of God and the will of God. Isaiah, writing not only about Israel, but also about Judah, foretold the same thing concerning even Judah. Ignorance will destroy us. We must know what the Bible teaches. Doesn't John 8:31 and 32 tell us that? "If you continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." What about those haunting words of Jesus from the cross recorded in Luke 23 when Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." When Peter preached the second recorded sermon we have in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 3, and in verse 17 he said, after referring to the crucifixion of Jesus, he said, the King James says, "what," W-O-T, a word that means "no, I wot," or "I know that you did it through ignorance." Didn't they know they were crucifying a man? Yes. But because of their prejudice and because of that mob mentality that prevailed when he was standing before Pilate, they cried out concerning Jesus, "Crucify him, crucify him," ignorant of the significance of what they were doing. Paul would say in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, that we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom, which God before ordained before the world for our glory. And then he said in verse 8, which none of the princes of this world knew, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the King of glory. Oh, if they'd only known the significance. But they could have, couldn't they? Didn't John say in John 20, 30 and 31, "Truly many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might know that Jesus is the Son of God, and that believing, or that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God and believing you might have life through His name. The book of John, the 21 chapters of John, is an apologetic laid out especially for the purpose of establishing faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, God in the flesh. They had all of that evidence there in person before them, but they rejected it. Why? Ignorance. Prejudice and pride, no doubt, played a part. Friends, there are people today, is it possible that even me or you could be one over whom Satan tonight has an advantage because of our ignorance? Because of something we don't know, and therefore we're not able to do what we ought to do or abstain from that which we ought not? Remember what Paul told Timothy? 2 Timothy 2:15. Study, the King James says, American Standard, give diligence. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. How diligent, how much effort do we put forth in the study of the Bible that will give us the knowledge we need so that Satan doesn't get an advantage? I've mentioned this before. I want to use it again just for illustration's sake. But I've mentioned that I have done a class now for about 7 years at the Smith County Jail on Tuesdays. Obviously not today. The question that, and the topic that generates more discussion than any other topic that we've ever talked about in that jail so far, in that class so far, is the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage. I find that interesting. I find it interesting that that generates more discussion than the subject of baptism. More discussion than the subject of the nature of the church. Because so many of those men that come to my class and the ladies that come to our ladies' class that meets on Tuesday evening come with the denominational concept of the church, and yet it is not the church that generates the most discussion. It's marriage, indoors, and remarriage, and here's why. Because there are several of those men who have been married now 2-3 times, and some of them are now living with a woman without being married to her. And what has happened to those men is, and I've pointed this out to them one day when we were having this discussion. When you got married the first time to the woman that became your wife, you didn't think anything about God. You weren't concerned about living right and doing right. It didn't matter to you that God was the one that joined you together. You simply got married. And then when things didn't work out, you couldn't get along, you divorced. Sometime later, you got married again. Again, you weren't thinking about God and what the Bible teaches about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. It didn't matter. You just wanted to get married. You were in love, or thought you were, and you married. Maybe you're still with that second one, or maybe you have left that one, and now you've got a third one, or you're just living with somebody. And now here you are in jail, and you've begun to think about the Bible, and we've come to the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and all of a sudden you found out, wait a minute. You're telling me that I don't have the right to be married to the one I'm married to. What am I supposed to do? I believe that illustrates perfectly what we're talking about tonight. Their ignorance of what God taught about marriage to start with has led them into a course of life that has brought them to the place where Satan has an advantage over them. And there is a bond there that is difficult to get people to break. I know of only about 3 instances where a man and a woman were unscripturally married, were members of the Lord's church, realized that they did not have the right to be married one to the other. Perhaps neither one of them had the right to remarry, or one of them didn't. They didn't have the right to be married one to the other. And I know of only 3 instances where they separated and lived apart because they knew they did not have the right to be married. That's the exception rather than the rule. It's hard to get people. Once they have tangled up their life in unscriptural relationships, to be willing to love God more than husband or wife and break that bond that the state made, not the Lord. The Lord didn't join them together to start with. Satan gets an advantage through ignorance. Now, it may not be marriage and divorce and remarriage in my case. It may be something else. But that's why we need to be diligent students of the Word of God. Who knows tonight what there may be in our Bibles of which we are ignorant, for which we stand before God guilty, and we have no knowledge of it, and Satan has the advantage, because we'll just keep right on living that way and doing that because we don't know any better. We don't feel guilt. We don't know any better. Wasn't Saul of Tarsus such a man? He could say, with all sincerity, I have lived in all good conscience before God to this day. But Paul, there was a time in your life when you were a zealous persecutor of the church. Absolutely, he would call himself the chief of sinners, wouldn't he? But he didn't know any better at that time. Oh, he could have, but he didn't. And Satan had the advantage. Now, there's no way you can say, well, I know he's got advantage. No, what do you? But the question is, are you a diligent student to make sure that you don't let Satan have an advantage over your life? The second way he can get an advantage over us is through deception. And it's amazing how many times there are in the Bible, and especially even in the New Testament, warning upon warning against being deceived. And especially against deceiving our own selves. In 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 18, Paul would say, let no man deceive himself. If any among you thinketh himself to be wise in this world, let him become a fool that he may be wise. Deceives himself. In James 1 verse 22, James said, be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. And just a few verses later, down in verse 26, he would say, if any among you seems to be religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is vain, empty, without any purpose, without value, but deceived. Thus, there are multitudes of people in the world today. They are religious, but they're deceived. What about those folks on Mars Hill in Acts 17? Had constructed idols to every god they knew about, unless there was one they didn't to be safe. They had one, and the inscription was to the unknown god. Oh, they were trying to cover all the bases, weren't they? Religious. But they were deceived. Paul, there on Mars Hill in Athens, preached unto them the one true and living God of whom they knew nothing. They were both ignorant and deceived. We can deceive ourselves. Obadiah, in that one chapter book, in the third verse, says, to the nation of Edom, the descendants of Esau, he said, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. O thou that dwellest in the high places and whose habitation is there, who has said, who will bring me down to the ground? They lived among the rocks on the side of cliffs. And for any army to come and try to attack them, it was basically futile. But God was now ready to deal with the Edomites because of their opposition to the children of Israel. He's going to bring judgment upon them. And their pride that they lived in a place where they were secure and where the enemies couldn't get to them was all in vain, because God was going to bring a nation against them and God would cause that nation to be successful. But the pride of their heart deceived them. That can happen to me. It can happen to you. Maybe you've said or you've heard somebody say, well, I'll never do that. Really? Are you sure? When you were younger and single or maybe newly married, did you ever say, well, I'll guarantee you my children will never behave that way? Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they didn't. But you know what that is? That's a little bit of pride. And we're deceived. It's easy to be deceived. In Ephesians 4:14, Paul expresses the fact that spiritual gifts were given for the work of the church in the early days, that he said that we should be no more children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine and the sleight of men and the cunning craftiness whereby they lie in wait to deceive. There were false teachers everywhere then, as there are now. Now, obviously, they didn't think they were false teachers then, as they do not now. But because they were not teaching the truth, to be led astray by that error would cause one then to be deceived. Is it in Galatians 3 and verse 1 where Paul would say, O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? They had obeyed the gospel according to Galatians 1 verse 6. But then false teachers had come in and they'd been deceived and led astray thereby. Paul would say in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3, let no man deceive you, for that day shall not come except there be first a falling away. He's talking about that apostasy that would occur before the second coming of Christ would come. And there were those who were deceiving and would deceive them by their error. And the tragedy about being deceived is we're not aware that we are when deceived when it occurs. And while ignorance can certainly contribute to deception, it's not always because of ignorance. Sometimes it's because of our own selfish desires. We've already touched on 2 Timothy 4 in the course of this meeting, where Paul said the time would come when they would not endure sound doctrine, but having itching ears, they would heap to themselves teachers after their own lust, and would be turned away from the truth and be turned to a fable. Paul is warning Timothy that the time was coming when people would say to him as a preacher, you preach it the way we want it. You preach it the way we like it. And what about Mother Eve, 1 Timothy 2:14? One of the reasons that God gives through the inspiration of Paul in that epistle for the restricted role of women in public assemblies of the church is because he said Adam was not deceived, but Eve was deceived in the transgression. The other reason he gives of the two was because Adam was first formed and then Eve. Now, you and I may wonder and quibble about why God chose those reasons, but God gave those reasons for the restricted role of women in the public service and the leadership of the church. And they have nothing to do with culture. It goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. But the point here is that Eve knew what God had said. Now, God didn't tell Eve, evidently, because in Genesis chapter 2, God told Adam that of every tree that's in the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree in the midst of the garden you shall not eat thereof, for in the day you eat you shall surely die. And that, according to the Genesis record in Genesis 2, was before God had created Eve from a rib out of Adam's side. And thus, either God told her or Adam told her. But in either case, she knew. In fact, if you'll remember the text, you'll remember that when Satan asked her, has God not said you can eat of every tree in the garden? She said, of every tree that is in the garden except the tree that is in the midst of the garden. For we should not eat of it, neither should we touch it. Now that may have been good advice. You're not going to eat it if you don't touch it. But so far as the text is concerned, God didn't tell them they couldn't touch it, did he? He told them not to eat it. And Eve added that restriction, or else Adam added it. But Satan deceived her in spite of her knowing what God had said. Why? She saw that it was pleasant to the eye, good for food, to be desired to make one wise. Selfish desires led her to be deceived. That can happen to me. That can happen to you. And when that happens, folks, Satan gains an advantage over us because we're no longer following the truth. We've been deceived. In 1 John 3 and verse 7, John said, "Let no man deceive you. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he," that is God, "is righteous." Now, there are other verses we could know, but we need to move on. A third way that Satan can gain an advantage over me and you is through indifference. Have you ever seen anybody just cease to care? You sometimes will see a husband or a wife cease to care about their marriage. You ever seen parents where their children have ceased to care anything about them? They just don't care anymore. Doesn't matter what you do to them or do with them. They don't care. Put them in a nursing home. Do whatever you want to. Just, we don't care. Have you ever seen church members who cease to care? They'll come and occupy a place on the pew during the assemblies. They really don't care anymore. They're just there to check off a list of things that they have to do, but they don't really care. You may even hear them talk about their home congregation and talk about what they're doing over there. They don't really care. Satan gains an advantage over us when we cease to care. All of you are familiar, I know, with Revelation 3, 15 and 16, where Jesus, in addressing the church of Laodicea, said, "I know your works, that you're neither hot nor cold. I would that you were hot or cold. And because you are neither hot or cold, I will spew you out of my mouth and cease to care." Jeremiah 48 and verse 10, these words are haunting words where Jeremiah, God through Jeremiah, said, "Cursed is the man that doeth the work of the Lord deceitfully." Now, this is one case where it helps to look up a Bible word in a Bible dictionary. The word deceitfully carries the idea, in fact, the American Standard translates it negligently. The English Standard Version says, "Cursed is a man that does the work of the Lord with slackness." You've seen people at work. They just sort of go through the motions. Maybe they've reached a place where they don't much care anymore. If they get fired, fine. They just don't really care. Sometimes that happens in the Lord's church. And when it does, Satan has gained an advantage. Remember, we noted earlier, 2 Timothy 2:15, "Study, give diligence." May I ask you tonight, have you ceased to care about Bible study? Now, I haven't been watching, and I'm not going to watch when the service is over. But I notice at Rome, we're considerably smaller than you are here at Fairview, and it amazes me. The number of men and women that come to Bible study without a Bible. There's one man in that congregation. I've never seen a Bible in his hand. I've been there nearly 23 years. Never seen a Bible in his hand. Now, maybe he's got it memorized. But I've never seen him with a Bible in his hand. He's never spoken up in class. In fact, most of the time, he's checking his eyelid for holes. You'll figure out what that means in a little while. Have we ceased to be interested? Have we become indifferent about it? Have we said, "Preacher, that's what we're paying you for, so you just tell us what it means"? And that's how we, in ignorance, become deceived and give Satan that advantage. We must not be indifferent. In Jeremiah 20, there was a time when Jeremiah, in discouragement, as he often was, came to a place where he said, I'm not going to preach and teach anymore. You remember earlier in about chapter 5, I believe it is, where he says, oh, that my eyes were fountains. He could not cry enough for the heartbreak over his nation. But finally, he came to the place where he said, I'm just done. But he said, the Word of God was like a fire in my bones. He could not be indifferent. He couldn't stop caring. What about those who are unfaithful? What about those who are lost? We can become indifferent to those things. And when we do, Satan has an advantage. Fourthly, Satan gains an advantage over us if we give up. I've already touched on Jeremiah. He wanted to, but he didn't. But he gains an advantage over us if we give up. And oh, how many times have we in discouragement thought about just quitting? I'll guarantee you, every preacher you've ever had, ever will have, has those moments when he looks at the work he's done, he's looked at the lessons that he's prepared, he looks at the responses that have not come in the way he desired, and he thinks, maybe I need to just quit. Maybe this isn't what I need to be doing. I don't know of a preacher that I've ever talked with or ever known that didn't have those moments. And when you're younger, they come more frequently than they do, seems like, when you get a little older. But even when you get a little older, you still have them. But remember what Paul said in Galatians 6, again in verse 7, he said, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever man sows, that shall he also reap. He that sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. He that sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Then in verse 9 he said, wherefore, let us be not weary in well-doing. For in due season we will reap if we faint not. I don't believe Paul is suggesting that we'll not reap anything, but if we keep on doing good, we'll reap for that good because of the law of sowing and reaping. Well, what are we going to do if we quit? If we give up? There's too much at stake. Not only is my soul at stake, but what about the soul of my wife if I just sit down and quit one day? What about the soul of my children and grandchildren and the example that I am to them if I just give up and quit? What does that say to them? There's too much at risk. Revelation 2:10, you remember the church at Smyrna, Jesus said that some of you are going to be cast into prison. Some of you will have tribulation 10 days. But he closed out that statement by saying, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Don't quit. Don't quit. You have heard, and rightly so, that the little preposition unto there does not mean you be faithful as long as you live. That's true. But in the context of the conditions in Smyrna, Jesus is saying, you be faithful to me even if they take your life for that faithfulness. And if they do that, I will give you the crown of life. Don't renounce me. Don't quit. Not even in the face of death. Now perhaps all of us tonight would be like Peter. We'd say with him, Lord, I'm really ready to go to Jerusalem. I'm ready to suffer. I'm ready to die for you. And maybe we are. I trust we are. But that needs to be our disposition. That there is not anything anybody can do There's not anything my family can do. There's not anything my friends can do. There's not anything my congregation can do that is going to cause me to give up on serving Jesus. When I get home Wednesday night, I may have a pink slip waiting for me. We appreciate your 22 and a half years service, but we think it's time to get somebody else. Well, if that's the way you feel, I'll just quit. No. I may not be able to keep serving the Lord there, but I can serve Him somewhere. And that's got to be my disposition. That there's not anything anybody can do that's going to cause me to quit serving Jesus. Too many people are too ready to quit. And that gives Satan the advantage. And the last thing I want to mention in the last 3 or 4 minutes is making excuses gives Satan the advantage. A preacher that used to be at Rome prior to my being there used to say that an excuse is the skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. The skin of a reason, in case you're writing that down, an excuse is the skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. An excuse may sound good, but it's not sound reasoning. And it's easy to make excuses, isn't it? Remember in Luke chapter 14, Jesus told about a man who gave a banquet. He sent his servants out to invite people to come in. And your Bible says, beginning in about verse 16 or 17 in the giving of that parable, that when the invitation was given, that all of those invited began with one consent to make excuse. They didn't all give the same excuses, but they all gave excuses. They all gave an excuse. One of them said, I bought a piece of land. I can't come. I need to go see about it. Who buys land without going to see it? The second one said, well, I've bought 5 yoke of oxen. I need to go test them, prove them. Who buys oxen without proving them first? The third one said, well, I've married a wife and I cannot come. And he's the only one that came close to having a reason. But even that was a pretty shallow excuse. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5 allowed that a married man, when he married, for the first year of his marriage, he was not to be involved in military service, nor was there to be any business required of him. And there's a lot of discussion about what that means. But the point is that the first year of their married life, they expected that man to be able to give devotion to his marriage and to establishing that marriage on firm footing. Well, this man said, I've married a wife and can't come. How would that keep him from disturbing his marriage? In fact, someone has observed most every new wife would be happy to go to a banquet. They all began to make excuse. Remember Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden made excuse. Adam said, the woman you gave me. He blamed Eve and he blamed God, didn't he? Eve said, well, it was that old serpent. But God didn't accept either one of their excuses. He held both of them accountable for what they'd done because they'd sinned. And so it will be for me. I can't help it. I had a man one time was talking about his tongue. He said, I say things and I just can't help it. He said, I'm sort of like a garbage can. And the fellow observed, and even a garbage can needs a lid on it every once in a while. But he could control his tongue because you never say anything that doesn't come from the heart. Isn't that what the Bible tells us? Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And you've never said a word that you didn't first think about before you said it. And you could have stopped it right there before it ever crossed your lips. You say, I can't help it. Well, I know that's not true because in 1 Corinthians 10:13, Paul tells us that there's no temptation that has taken you but such as is common to man. God is faithful and will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation provide the way of escape. There's always a way of escape. I have never faced any trial, and I have never faced any enticement to sin to which I did not have a way out. It may not have been pleasant, but it was a way. What about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They had a way out, didn't they? And they took it. They were enticed to deny God, to bow down and worship that image Nebuchadnezzar had made. And we're told, if you don't, I'm going to cast you into that fire. That was their way out. And they took it. In their case, God miraculously spared their lives. He didn't always do that. And He doesn't do it today. The way out may be death, but just like Revelation 2:10 says, on the other side of that, there's the crown of life. And we have to trust God so that we do not deny Him and we do not give Satan the advantage. Satan is after you. He's been after you tonight to try to take your mind off onto something else. He's been after you tonight to deny the Bible that you've heard. He's after me. He's after every one of us. And He is relentless. He doesn't quit. You remember the statement in the temptation of Jesus, Matthew 4 and Luke 4? Luke tells us in verse 13 that when the devil had ended all of those temptations of Jesus, he departed from him for a season. Now, the rest of what we read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is never specifically identified to us and for us as an occasion of temptation for Jesus. But Luke tells us that when the devil left him, he wasn't through with Jesus. He was through with him for that period of time, but he wasn't through. He just left him for a season. And he's not through with me and you. Whatever success I may have had today in resisting and fighting him, he'll be back tomorrow. And the next day, and the next day, as long as I draw breath into my body, he's relentless. And he's looking for that advantage. Let's make sure we don't give him advantage. There may be other ways, but these are some. And when he gets them, when he gains that advantage, he latches on. And you've got to fight him. If you keep studying the Bible, you will likely learn, there's things I should have been doing, I haven't been. Will you let him continue to hold on to you? Or will you resist him and turn from him? He teaches us that you've got to believe in Christ. John 8:24. God teaches us that we have to repent. Everybody's commanded to. Acts 17:30. All men everywhere. That we confess with our mouth that faith in our heart. Romans 10:9 and 10. And that we submit to allow ourselves to be buried with him by baptism into his death, Romans 6:3, that's where the blood washes us away, washes our sins away. And into our death, Romans 6:4, that's where we die to sin. And then we're raised up to walk in newness of life. If you've given Satan advantage up to this point in time by not obeying that gospel, then will you shake him loose tonight? Come down this aisle and put on Christ in your submission and obedience to the gospel. And if you're a child of God, have you given him advantage through ignorance, through deceit? Well, you may not know for sure, but what about through indifference? Have you quit? Have you sort of decided that I'm just not going to do what I've been doing because it doesn't seem to matter to anybody? It matters to God. Hebrews 6 and verse 10 says that God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love that you do show toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. Don't quit. If nobody else ever pats you on the back, one day it will not matter when you hear the Lord say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Don't quit. And don't make excuses. If you've sinned, say, I've sinned. I've done wrong. And I want to fix it. You come and let good brethren pray with you and pray for you. If that be your need, whatever it might be, while we stand together and while we sing.